Chapter 16. Amy hated crowds, but the idea of plunging into the middle of 7 million dead people didn't bother her. Nellie, Dan, and she hurried down a metal staircase. They found themselves in a limestone corridor with metal pipes running overhead and dim electric lights. The warm air smelled of mildew and wet rock.
"Only one exit, guys," Nellie said nervously. "If we get caught down here..."
"The tunnel should branch out soon," Amy said, trying to sound more confident than she felt.
The stone walls were etched with graffiti. Some looked recent, some ancient. One inscription was engraved on a marble slab right above their heads.
"Stop mortals," Nellie translated. "This is the Empire of Death."
"Cheerful,"
Dan muttered. They kept walking. The floor under Amy's feet was slushy gravel. Amy was still thinking about Uncle Alistair. Had he really known something about their parents, or was he just manipulating them? She tried to put it out of her mind.
"Where are the bones?"
Dan asked. Then they turned a corner into a large room, and Dan said,
"Oh."
It was the creepiest place Amy had ever seen. Against the walls, human bones were stacked like firewood from the floor to above Amy's head. The remains were yellow and brown, mostly leg bones, but skulls stared out here and there like patches on a quilt. A line of skulls topped each stack. Amy walked in awed silence. The next room was the same as the first, wall after wall of moldering remains. Dim electric lights cast eerie shadows over the dead, making their empty eye sockets look even scarier.
"Gross," Nellie managed. "There's like thousands."
"Millions," Amy said. "This is only one small part."
"They dug all these people up?"
Dan asked.
"Who would want that job?"
Amy didn't know, but she was amazed how the workers had made patterns with skulls in the stacks of femurs. Diagonals, stripes, connect the dot shapes. In a weird, horrible way, it was almost beautiful. In the third room, they found a stone altar with unlit candles.
"We need to find the oldest section," Amy said. "These bones are too recent. Look at the plaque. It's from 1804.
She led the way. Eyeless sockets of the dead seemed to stare at them as they passed.
"These are cool,"
Dan decided.
"Maybe I could..."
"No, Dan," Amy said. "You can't collect human bones."
"Aw."
Nellie mumbled something that sounded like a prayer in Spanish.
"Why would Benjamin Franklin want to come down here?"
"He was a scientist,"
Amy kept walking, reading the dates on the brass plaques.
"He liked public works projects. This would have fascinated him."
"Millions of dead people," Nellie said. "Real fascinating."
They turned down a narrow corridor and found themselves facing a metal gate. Amy shook the bars. The gate creaked open like it hadn't been used in hundreds of years.
"Are you sure we should go down there?"
Nellie asked. Amy nodded. The dates were getting older. On the other hand, there were no metal pipes on the ceiling up ahead, which meant no electric lights.
"Anybody got a flashlight?"
she asked.
"Yeah,"
Nellie said.
"On my keychain."
She pulled out her keys and handed them to Amy. There was a little push-button pin light. Not much, but better than nothing. They kept going. After 100 feet, they emerged in a small room with only one other exit. Amy shone the flashlight on an old plaque framed in skulls.
1785! These have to be the first bones put down here.
The wall they were looking at was in bad shape. The bones were brown and crumbly, and some had scattered across the floor. The skulls along the top had been crushed, though the ones quilted into the wall looked fairly intact. They were done in a square pattern. Nothing exciting.
"Search around," Amy said. "It has to be here."
Dan stuck his hands into some of the gaps in the bone wall. Nellie checked the top of the stack. Amy looked into the skull's eye sockets with the flashlight, but she saw nothing.
"It's hopeless," she said at last. "If there was anything here, another team must have found it."
Dan scratched his head. Then he scratched a skull's head.
"Why are they numbered?"
Amy wasn't in the mood for his games.
"What numbers?"
Here, on the forehead.
Dan tapped one of the skulls.
This guy was number 3. Were they on a football team or something?
Amy leaned in closer. Dan was right. The number was very faint, but scratched into the skull's forehead, like someone had carved it with a knife, was the Roman numeral 3. She examined the skull below it. 19. A square pattern. Skulls with numbers.
Check them all. Quick!
It didn't take long. There were 16 skulls woven into the pile of bones, done in 4 rows and 4 columns. 3 of the skulls didn't have numbers. The rest did. A chill went down Amy's back.
Coordinates in a box. A magic box. What?
Dan said.
What magic?
Dan, can you memorize these numbers and their placement?
I already have.
We need to get out of here and find a map. This is the clue. Well, the clue to the real clue, whatever Franklin was hiding.
Wait a sec, Nellie said. Franklin scratched numbers on skulls? Why?
It's a magic box, Amy said. Franklin used to play with numbers when he got bored. Like when he was sitting in the Philadelphia Assembly and he didn't want to listen to the dull speeches. He would create magic boxes, number problems for himself. He would fill in the missing numbers. The sums had to match, horizontally and vertically.
Nellie scowled.
You're telling me Benjamin Franklin invented Sudoku? Well, yeah, in a way. And these are coordinates,
Dan supplied.
The missing sums show the location of the next clue.
Clapping echoed through the room.
Bravo!
Amy turned. Standing in the entrance were Ian and Natalie Cabra.
I told you they could do it,
Ian said to his sister.
Oh, I suppose,
Natalie conceded. Amy hated that even underground in a room full of bones, Natalie managed to look glamorous. She was wearing a black velour catsuit, so she looked 11 going on 23. Her hair hung loose around her shoulders. The only part of her outfit that didn't match was the tiny silver dart gun in her hand.
Perhaps it wasn't all bad that Irina failed us. You!
Dan yelled.
You convinced Irina to set us up at the Ile Saint-Louis. You almost got us buried in cement. A shame it didn't work, Natalie said. You would have made a fine welcome mat for the mausoleum.
But why?
Amy stammered. Ian smiled.
To put you out of commission, of course, and to give us extra time to find this place. We needed to make sure this wasn't some clever misdirection by our dear cousin Irina. I should have noticed the magic box earlier. Thanks for your help, Amy. Now, if you'll move aside, we'll just copy down those numbers and be off.
Amy took a shaky breath.
No.
Ian laughed.
Isn't she cute, Natalie, acting like she has a choice?
Yes.
Natalie wrinkled her nose.
Cute.
Amy blushed. The Cabras always made her feel so awkward and stupid, but she couldn't let them get the clue. She snatched up a leg bone.
One move and I'll crush the skulls. You'll never get the numbers.
It didn't sound like a very convincing threat, even to her, but Ian paled.
Now let's not be stupid, Amy. I know how nervous you get, but we won't hurt you.
Not at all,
Natalie agreed. She pointed her dart gun at Amy's face.
I think poison 6 will be adequate. Nothing lethal, just a deep, deep sleep. I'm sure someone will find you down here. Someday.
A shadow loomed up behind the Cabras. Suddenly, Uncle Alistair charged into the room and knocked Natalie to the ground. Her dart gun skittered away and Ian dove after it.
Run!
Alistair yelled. Amy didn't argue. She, Nellie, and Dan raced through the other exit, into the darkness, deeper into the catacombs. They ran for what seemed like hours, with nothing but the pinlight to guide them. They turned down one corridor and found it blocked by a mound of rubble. They doubled back and followed another tunnel until it submerged completely in murky yellow water. Soon, Amy had no idea which direction they were heading.
Alistair said there are police down here,
she murmured.
I wish one would find us.
But they saw no one. The little flashlight started to dim.
No,
Amy said.
No, no, no.
They forged ahead, 50 feet, 60 feet, and their light went out completely. Amy found Dan's hand and squeezed it tight.
It's going to be fine, kiddos,
Nellie said, but her voice was quavering.
We can't be lost down here forever.
Amy didn't see why not. The catacombs went on for miles and had never been mapped completely. There was no reason anyone would come looking for them.
We could shout for help,
Dan said.
It won't do any good,
Amy said gloomily.
I'm sorry, guys. This is not how I wanted things to end.
It's not the end,
Dan said.
We could follow one wall until we find another exit. We could...
Shh, Amy said.
I'm just saying... Dan, seriously, be quiet. I thought I heard something.
The tunnel was silent except for the distant drip of water. Then Amy heard it again, a faint rumbling from somewhere in front of them.
A train?
Nellie asked. Amy's spirits lifted.
We must be near a metro station. Come on!
She shuffled forward with her hands outstretched. She shuddered as she touched a wall of bones, but she followed the corridor as it twisted to the right. Gradually, the rumbling sounds grew louder. Amy groped to the left. Her hand touched metal.
A door!
She cried.
Dan, there's some kind of lock mechanism here. Come here and figure this out. Where?
She found him in the dark and guided his hands to the lock. Within seconds, the hatch creaked open and they were blinded by electric light. It took Amy a few moments to comprehend what she was seeing. The hatch was more like a window than a door, a square opening about 5 feet off the ground, just big enough to crawl through if they climbed up to it. They were eye level with the side of some railroad tracks, metal rails on wooden ties, and something brown and furry was scampering over the gravel bed. Amy jumped.
A rat!
The rodent regarded her, clearly unimpressed, then scurried on its way.
It's a rail pit,
Dan said.
We can climb out and...
The light got brighter. The whole tunnel rumbled. Amy fell back and cupped her ears against the sound, like a herd of dinosaurs. A train blasted past in a blur of metal wheels. It sucked the air right out of their tunnel, pulling her clothes and hair toward the hatch. Then, just as suddenly, it was gone. When she was sure her voice would work again, she said,
We can't go out there. We'll get killed. Look,
Dan said.
There's a service ladder about 5 feet down. We'll crawl up to the rails, run to the ladder, and climb to the platform. Easy.
That's not easy. What if another train comes?
We can time it,
Nellie suggested.
I've got a clock on my iPod.
She pulled it out of her pocket, but she'd hardly pressed the wheel before another train roared by. Nellie's glittery eyeshadow made her face look ghostly in the dim light.
That was less than 5 minutes. The rails must be for express trains. We'll have to hurry.
Right,
Dan said, and just like that, he scrambled up and out of the hatch.
Dan!
Amy shouted. He turned, crouching on the tracks.
Come on!
In a daze, Amy let Nellie give her a boost. With Dan's help, she crawled out.
Now help me with Nellie,
Dan said.
But watch the third rail.
Amy stiffened. 2 feet away was the black electric rail that ran the trains. She knew enough about subways to understand that one touch would be worse than 1,000 Franklin batteries. She helped Nellie out of the hatch, but it was a tight squeeze. They lost time. The rails hissed and clicked beneath them.
I'm okay, Nellie said, brushing off her clothes. Let's get to the ladder.
Dan started to follow, but he lurched when he tried to stand, like he was caught on something.
Dan?
Amy said.
It's my backpack,
he said.
It's wedged.
He tugged at it helplessly. Somehow, one strap had gotten looped around a metal rail, and the rail had shifted, clamping the pack into place.
Leave it,
Amy cried. Nellie was already at the ladder, yelling at them to hurry. Passengers on the platform were starting to notice them, too. They were yelling in alarm, shouting in French. Dan slipped the backpack off his shoulder, but it was still stuck to the rail. He tugged at it and tried to open it, but he wasn't having any luck.
Now!
Nellie yelled. Amy could feel a faint rumbling in the tracks at her feet.
Dan, she pleaded, it's not important. I can get it, just another second.
Dan, no, it's just a backpack.
It won't open.
The far end of the tunnel lit up. Nellie was right above them on the platform, reaching out her hand. A lot of other passengers were doing the same, imploring them to grab hold.
Amy, Nellie cried, you first.
She didn't want to, but maybe if she went first, Dan would see reason. She grabbed Nellie's hand, and Nellie hauled her from the rail pit. Immediately, Amy turned and stuck her hand out to Dan.
Dan, please, she called. Now!
The train's headlight flashed into sight. Wind rushed through the tunnel. The ground trembled. Dan gave the backpack another tug, but it wouldn't budge. He looked at the train, and Amy saw he was crying. She didn't understand why.
Dan, take my hand!
She leaned out as far as she could. The train barreled down on them. With a cry of anguish, Dan grabbed her hand, and with more strength than Amy knew she had, she yanked him out of the pit so hard they tumbled over each other. The train rushed on. When the noise died, the passengers on the platform all broke loose at once, scolding them in French while Nellie tried to explain and apologize. Amy didn't care what they were saying. She held her brother, who was crying harder than he had since he was little. She looked over the edge of the pit, but the backpack was gone, swept away into the tunnels by the force of the train. They sat for a long time while Dan shivered and wiped his eyes. Eventually, the passengers lost interest in them. They drifted away or stepped onto other trains and disappeared. No police came. Pretty soon it was just Nellie, Amy, and Dan sitting in a corner of the platform like a homeless family.
Dan,
Amy said gently,
what was in there? What did you have in the backpack?
He sniffed and rubbed his nose.
Nothing.
It was the worst lie Amy had ever heard. Usually she could tell what he was thinking just by looking at his face, but he was hiding his thoughts from her. She could only tell that he was miserable.
Forget it,
he said.
We don't have time.
Are you sure?
I said forget it. We need to figure out that number box before the cobras, don't we?
She didn't like it, but he was right. Besides, something told her that if they stayed here much longer, the police would come and start asking questions. She took one last look at the rail pit where Dan had almost died and the dark hatch that led into the catacombs. Fear still coursed through her body, but they'd been through too much to give up now.
Let's go then,
she said.
We've got a clue to find.
Outside, it had started to rain. By the time they found a cafe, Dan seemed back to normal, or at least they'd come to a silent agreement that they would act like everything was normal. They sat under the awning to dry off while Nellie ordered food. Amy didn't think she could eat, but she was hungrier than she'd realized. It was 5 in the afternoon. They'd been in the catacombs a long time. She shuddered as she thought about Ian and Natalie and the poison dart gun. She hoped Uncle Alistair was all right. She still didn't trust him, but there was no denying he'd saved them in the catacombs. She had terrible thoughts of the old man lying alone and unconscious in the maze. As they ate brie and mushroom sandwiches, Dan drew skulls and Roman numerals on a napkin.
12, 5, 14, he said. Those are the missing numbers.
Amy didn't bother checking his math. He never messed up on number problems.
Maybe it's an address and an arrondissement, she said.
Nellie wiped off her iPod.
Wouldn't the address have changed in 200 years?
Amy got a hollow feeling in her gut. Nellie was probably right. Paris might not have had the arrondissement system when Franklin lived here, and street addresses definitely would have changed, in which case Franklin's clue was no good anymore. Would Grace have sent them on a search that couldn't be finished?
Why not?
A resentful voice said inside of her. Grace didn't care enough to tell you about the quest in person. If Dan had died in that rail pit, it would have been Grace's fault. No, she decided. That wasn't true. Grace must have had a reason. The numbers must refer to something else. Amy could only think of one way to find out. The same thing she did whenever she had an unsolvable problem.
We need to find a library.
Nelly talked to the waiter in French, and he seemed to understand what they wanted.
Pas de problème, he said.
He drew a map on a fresh napkin and scribbled the name of a metro station, École Militaire.
We have to hurry, Nelly said. He says the library closes at 6.
Half an hour later, soggy and still smelling like the catacombs, they arrived at the American Library in Paris.
Perfect, Amy said.
The old building had black metal security bars over the doorway, but they were open. Peering inside, Amy saw stacks of books and plenty of comfortable places to read.
Why should these guys help us? Dan asked. I mean, we don't have a library card or anything.
But Amy was already climbing the steps. For the first time in days, she felt absolutely confident. This was her world. She knew what to do. The librarians came to their aid like soldiers responding to a battle cry. Amy told them she was researching Benjamin Franklin, and within minutes, Amy, Dan, and Nelly were sitting at a table in a conference room examining reproductions of Franklin documents. Some so rare, the librarians told her, the only copies existed in Paris.
Yeah, here's a rare grocery list, Dan muttered. Wow.
He was about to toss it aside when Amy grabbed his wrist.
Dan, you never know what's important. Back then there weren't many stores. If you wanted to buy something, you had to send the merchant an order and have your stuff shipped. What did Franklin buy?
Dan sighed.
Please to send the following. 3. Treatise on cider making by Cave. 2. Nelson on the Government of Children, 8 volumes by Dodsley. 1 quantity iron solute, letters from a Russian officer.
Hold it, Amy said.
Iron solute? Where have I heard that before? It was on that other list, Dan said without hesitation, in one of the letters we saw in Philadelphia.
Amy frowned. But iron solute isn't a book. This whole list is books except for that.
What's iron solute anyway?
Dan asked.
Oh, guys, I know this.
Nelly chimed in. She held up her hands and closed her eyes like she was remembering the answer for a test.
It's like a chemical solution, right? They use it for metalworking and printing and a bunch of other stuff.
Amy stared at her.
How did you know that?
Hey, I took chemistry last semester. I remember 'cause the professor was talking about, like, how they make high-end cooking equipment. Franklin probably used iron solute for his ink when he was a printer.
That's great, Dan muttered, except for the fact that it's completely unimportant. Now can we get back to the magic box coordinates?
Amy still felt something nagging in the back of her head, like she was missing a connection, but she rifled through the rest of the papers. Finally, she unfolded a huge yellowing document that turned out to be an old-fashioned map of Paris. Her eyes widened.
This is it.
Amy put her finger proudly over a spot on the map.
A church. Saint-Pierre de Montmartre. That's where we need to go.
How can you be sure?
Nelly asked.
The numbers form a grid, see?
She pointed to the margins.
This is an old surveyor's map by a couple of French scientists, Comte de Buffon and Thomas-François d'Alibard. I remember reading about them. They were the first to test Franklin's lightning rod theories. After they proved the rods worked, King Louis XVI ordered them to draw up a plan to outfit all the major buildings in Paris. That church was the 14th installation at coordinates 5 by 12. Franklin would have known about the work. He was really proud of how the French took to his ideas. That has to be it. I'll bet you a box of French chocolate we'll find an entrance to the catacombs at the church.
Dan looked doubtful. Outside, the rain was really coming down. Thunder shook the windows of the library.
What if the Cabras get there first?
We have to make sure that doesn't happen, Amy said.
Come on!
Chapter 17. Dan felt like one of the catacomb skulls, hollowed out inside. He was determined not to show it. He was embarrassed enough that he'd cried on the train platform, but
but he kept reaching for his backpack, and it wasn't there. He couldn't stop thinking about his parents' picture, whisked away and lost in the metro tunnels. Maybe it had been ripped to shreds, or maybe his parents would be smiling in the darkness forever, with no company but the rats. All he'd wanted to do was make them proud. Now he didn't know if his parents would ever forgive him. The rain was still coming down. Thunder boomed across the sky. Every few minutes, a flash of lightning would illuminate the Paris skyline. If Dan had been in a better mood, he would have wanted to explore Montmartre. It looked like a cool neighborhood. The whole area was one big hill, topped with a massive white-domed church that glowed in the rain.
"That's where we're going?"
Dan asked. Amy shook her head.
"That's the Sacré-Cœur Basilica. The smaller church, Saint-Pierre, is just below it. You can't see it from here."
"Two churches right together?"
"Yeah.
Why wouldn't Franklin choose the big fancy one?"
Amy shrugged.
"Wasn't his style. He liked simple architecture. He would have thought it amusing to choose a small, plain church in the shadow of a big, fancy one."
That didn't make much sense to Dan, but he was too wet and tired to argue. They hiked up the narrow streets, passing nightclubs with music blaring and neon signs that gleamed against the wet pavement.
"I used to have a nightlife,"
Nellie sighed. As they climbed toward the top of the hill, Amy told them what she knew about the neighborhood. How famous artists used to live here, like Picasso, Vincent van Gogh, and Salvador Dali. Nellie pulled her raincoat tighter.
"My mom told me another story, why it's called Montmartre, the Hill of the Martyr.
She said Saint Denis was beheaded at this summit, right where we're going."
That didn't sound like a very good omen. Dan wondered if they still kept the head in the church, and whether saints' heads really had halos. A few minutes later, they stood in a muddy graveyard, looking up at the dark silhouette of Saint-Pierre de Montmartre. The church was probably taller than it seemed, but with the white basilica towering on the hill behind it, Saint-Pierre looked short. It was made of gray stone slabs. A single square bell tower rose from the left-hand side, topped with a lightning rod and cross. Dan thought the building looked angry and resentful. If churches could frown, this one would.
"How do we know where to look?" he asked.
"Inside the sanctuary?"
Nellie asked hopefully.
"At least we'd be out of the rain."
Boom! Thunder rolled across the rooftops, lightning flashed, and in that second, Dan saw something.
"There,"
he said.
"That tombstone."
"Dan," Amy complained, "this is no time for your collection."
But he ran to a marble marker. If he hadn't been a tombstone admirer, he never would have noticed it. There were no dates, no name. At first, Dan thought the figure carved at the top was an angel, but the shape was wrong. It was weathered and worn, but he could still tell.
"Entwined serpents," Amy gasped. "The Lucian crest. And there."
She knelt and traced an arrow carved at the base of the marker, an arrow pointing down into the earth. Amy and Dan looked at each other and nodded.
"Oh, you're kidding," Nellie said. "You're not really going to dig up a grave,"
Dan said. They found a tool shed around the side of the church. They borrowed a shovel, a couple of gardening spades, and a flashlight that actually worked. Soon they were back at the graveside, digging in the mud. The rain made it hard going. In no time, they were completely filthy. It reminded Dan of the good old days when Amy and he were young. They used to have mud battles, and their au pair would shriek in horror and make them spend the evening in a bubble bath getting cleaned up. Dan didn't think Nellie was going to make them a bubble bath tonight. Slowly, the hole got deeper. It kept filling with water, but finally Dan's shovel struck stone. He scraped away the mud and found a marble slab about 4 feet long by 3 feet wide.
"Too small for a coffin,"
Amy said.
"Unless it's for a kid,"
Dan said.
"I could fit in there."
"Don't say that."
Dan wiped the mud off his face, which just made it muddier.
"Only one way to find out."
He worked the spade under the edge of the slab until he found a crack and then started to pry.
"I need help."
Amy joined him. Nellie got the shovel into the crack and together they heaved the slab aside. Beneath was a square hole, but it wasn't a grave. Stairs led down into the darkness of the catacombs. As soon as they reached the bottom, Dan swept the flashlight around the room. It was a square chamber hewn from limestone, with a tunnel exiting to the left and the right. There were no stacks of bones, but the walls were painted with faded murals. In the center was an ornately carved stone pedestal about 3 feet high. On the top sat a porcelain vase.
"Don't touch it," Amy said. "It might be booby-trapped."
Dan edged closer to the vase.
"It's decorated with little Franklins."
He could make out Ben holding a kite in a storm, Ben in a fur cap, Ben waving a cane over the ocean like he was doing some kind of magic trick.
"It's a souvenir vase," Amy said. "The kind they made in the 1700s to celebrate Franklin's arrival in Paris." $20 says something's inside," Dan offered.
"No bet," Amy said.
"Guys," Nellie said, "look at this."
She was standing at the back wall. Dan came over and shone the light on the mural. The colors were faded, but Dan could make out four figures, two men and two women dressed in old-fashioned clothes, even older than from Franklin's time, like from the Middle Ages or the Renaissance or something. Each was painted larger than life. On the far left was a thin, cruel-looking man with dark hair. He held a dagger that was almost hidden in his sleeve. Faded black letters at his feet read L. Cahill. Next to him stood a young lady with short blonde hair and intelligent eyes. She held an old-fashioned mechanism with bronze gears, like a navigation instrument or a clock. The inscription under the hem of her brown dress read K. Cahill. To her right was a huge dude with a thick neck and bushy eyebrows. He had a sword at his side. His jaw and his fists were clenched, like he was getting ready to slam his head into a brick wall. The inscription read, T. Cahill. Finally, on the far right, was a woman in a gold dress. Her red hair was gathered in a braid over one shoulder. She held a small harp, like one of those Irish harps Dan had seen in the St. Patrick's Day parade back home in Boston. Her inscription read, J. Cahill. Dan got the strangest feeling all four were watching him. They seemed angry, like he'd just interrupted them in the middle of a fight. But that was stupid. How could he tell that just from a wall painting?
"Who are they?" Nellie asked.
Amy touched the figure of L. Cahill, the man with the knife.
"L? For Lucian?"
"Yeah," Dan said.
He wasn't sure how, but he knew immediately that Amy was right. It was like he could read the expressions of the painted figures, the way he could sometimes do with Amy.
"Lucian Branch. That guy was the first. And K. Cahill..."
Amy moved to the lady with the mechanical device.
"Maybe K stood for Katrina or Catherine, like a Katerina Branch?"
"Maybe."
Dan looked at the guy with the sword.
"Then T for Thomas? Hey... he looks like the Holtz."
The picture of T. Cahill seemed to glare at him. Dan could totally see him in a purple running suit. Then Dan turned his attention to the last picture, the lady with the harp.
"And J for Janice. You think her name was Jane?"
Amy nodded.
"Could be. The first of the Janice. Look, she's got Jonah Wizard's eyes," Dan said.
The resemblance was eerie.
"These four," Amy said, "they look almost like brothers and sisters,"
Dan said. It wasn't just their similar features, it was their postures, their expressions. Dan had been in enough fights with Amy to recognize the look. These guys were siblings who'd spent years annoying each other. The way they were standing, like they knew each other intimately, but were also trying really hard not to throttle each other.
"Something must have happened between them," Amy said. "Something..."
Her eyes widened. She moved to the middle of the mural and brushed away some cobwebs between K and T. Cahill. There, small but clear on the painted horizon, was a burning house and a dark figure running away from it, someone shrouded in a black cloak.
A fire.
Amy clutched her jade necklace.
Like Grace's mansion. Like what happened to our parents. We haven't changed in all these centuries. We're still trying to destroy each other.
Dan ran his fingers across the mural. It made no sense that they could know who these people were, but he was sure Amy was right. He just knew it somewhere inside. He was looking at four siblings, the beginnings of the Cahill branches. He studied their faces the way he used to do with his parents' photograph, wondering who he resembled most.
But what happened? Nellie said. What was in that house?
Dan turned toward the stone pedestal.
I don't know, but I'm thinking it's time to open that vase.
Dan volunteered. Amy and Nellie stood back as he slowly lifted the vase off the pedestal. No poison arrows flew out, no spikes shot from the ceiling, and no snake pits opened up, which Dan found kind of disappointing. He was about to open the lid when Amy said,
"Wait."
She pointed to the base of the pedestal. Dan had noticed the carvings, but he hadn't realized exactly what they were.
"Is that sheet music?"
he asked. Amy nodded. Notes, lines, and stanzas were etched in the rock. A complicated song. It brought back bad memories of Dan's piano teacher, Mrs. Harsh, who'd quit giving him lessons last year after he painted her minor keys with crazy glue.
"What does it mean?"
he asked.
"I don't know," Amy said. "Franklin liked music."
"Probably just decoration," Dan said impatiently. Something was rattling around inside the vase, and he was itching to open it. He put his hand on the lid.
"Dan, no,"
Amy said. But he opened it. Nothing bad happened. Dan reached inside and pulled out a corked glass cylinder wrapped in paper.
"What is that?"
Amy asked.
"Liquid," Dan said. "A vial of something."
He untied the paper and tossed it aside.
"Hey," Amy said. "That could be important. It's just a wrapper."
She picked it up and unfolded it. She scanned whatever was on it and quickly tucked it in her shirt pocket. Dan didn't care about that. He was trying to decipher the words etched on the glass vial. Inside was a thick green liquid, like the slime he used to play with and throw at his friends. The inscription read, "Sa Othu Girch Sith Os I Girch Ethe Su Yit Sulsulki, Het, Earthut, Ot, Ephre."
"What is that?"
Nellie said.
"German?"
Amy asked.
"Uh-uh," Nellie said. "That's no language I've ever seen."
Suddenly, Dan's whole body tingled. The letters started rearranging themselves in his head.
"It's one of those word puzzles," he announced, "where they scramble the letters."
"An anagram?" Amy said.
"How can you tell?"
Dan couldn't explain. It just made sense to him, the same way numbers did, or locks, or baseball card stats.
"Give me a piece of paper and a pen."
Amy fished around in her bag. The only paper she could find was a piece of cream cardstock, their original clue about poor Richard, but Dan didn't care. He gave Amy the vial and took the paper. He turned it over and wrote on the back, unscrambling the anagram word by word. "As thou charge this, so I charge thee. Use thy skills, the truth, to free." Nellie whistled.
"Okay, I'm impressed."
"It's the second clue," Dan said. "The second big one. This has to be it."
Amy frowned doubtfully.
"Maybe. But what does it mean? As thou charge this?"
Suddenly, light flooded the room.
"Good job, cuz."
At the foot of the stairs, dripping wet but looking quite pleased with himself, was Jonah Wizard. His father stood behind him with a video camera.
"Man, this'll make great TV."
Jonah smiled wickedly.
"This is the part where I swoop in, bust the lightweights and gank the clue.
Chapter 18. A rush of desperate energy filled Amy's body, like it had when she'd pulled Dan out of the rail pit. She hadn't come all this way to deal with a conceited jerk like Jonah Wizard. She imagined Grace's voice in her head, speaking with total confidence.
You will make me proud, Amy.
She raised the vial.
Back off, Jonah, or I'll smash it.
He laughed.
You wouldn't.
But he sounded nervous.
Awesome footage, Jonah's dad said. Keep it rolling, son. Great chemistry.
And put down that camera, Amy shouted.
Dan and Nellie stared at her in amazement, but Amy didn't care. She didn't care how valuable the vial might be, either. She'd had enough of the Cahill family's backstabbing. She was so angry she did feel like throwing the glass cylinder against the floor. Apparently, Jonah sensed it too.
All right, cuz, take it easy. We're all friends here, right?
The camera.
Amy stepped forward like she was going to charge him. Jonah flinched.
Dad, stop the camera. But son, just do it.
Reluctantly, Jonah's dad stopped filming.
Okay, Amy.
Jonah put on his dazzling smile.
We're good now, right? You know that's the second clue. If you destroy it, the whole quest ends. Nobody gets anything. That what you want?
Back up, she ordered. Into the corner. Go stand by Jane.
Jonah furrowed his eyebrows.
Who?
The mural. Go stand by the lady in the yellow. Your great-great-great-great-great-grandmother.
Jonah clearly didn't know what she was talking about, but he went along. He and his dad backed into the corner. Dan whistled.
Nice job, sis.
Get up the stairs, she told him. You too, Nellie. Hurry.
As soon as they were up, Amy followed, but she knew Jonah and his dad wouldn't stay put for long.
That was awesome.
Dan was bouncing up and down with excitement.
Can we see all them down there?
Dan, listen, she said. The inscription, as thou charge this. I think the stuff in this vial is inert.
What's inert?
Inert, like inactive. It needs energy to catalyze it. Franklin messed around with chemistry. When he says a charge,
Dan grinned.
Of course.
It's dangerous.
No choice.
What are you guys talking?
Nellie glanced toward the street.
Oh, poop. Look.
A purple ice cream truck was barreling toward them. It swerved to a stop in front of the gates. Eisenhower Holt scowled behind the wheel.
Inside the church, Amy said. Quick!
They raced up the path. Amy tugged open the sanctuary doors and crashed straight into a cherry red suit.
Hello, my dear children.
Uncle Alistair smiled down at them. He looked like a raccoon with his two black eyes. Standing next to him was Irina Spassky. Amy's heart crawled into her throat.
You and her?
Now, the old man said. I saved your life in the catacombs. I told you alliances are important. I'm simply making friends where I can. I suggest you hand over that vial, my dear. I would hate for Cousin Irina to use her persuasive techniques.
Irina extended her fingernails. A tiny needle sprouted from each one. Amy turned to run, but her eyes widened. Something was hurtling toward them from the street, a large white cube.
Duck!
She yelled. Nellie, Dan, and she hit the floor as a crate of ice cream sailed over their heads. The crate must have been from the back of the freezer because it crashed into Alistair and Irina like a block of cement and knocked them both flat.
Revenge time,
Eisenhower Holt yelled, pulling more frozen ammunition from the back of his van. Arnold the pit bull barked excitedly. The whole Holt family charged up the sidewalk, each holding a crate of creme glacée.
Amy,
Dan said nervously.
Are you?
He didn't finish, but she knew what he was asking. The last time they'd encountered the Holts, Amy had panicked.
This time she couldn't afford to. That Cahill mural in the secret room had steeled her willpower.
Nelly, get out of here, she ordered. They don't want you. Go call the police. But that's the best way you can help us. Go.
Amy didn't wait for an answer. She and Dan dashed inside the church, leaping over the groaning forms of Alistair and Arena. They ran toward the back of the sanctuary. Amy didn't have time to admire the church, but she felt like she'd plunged into the Middle Ages. Gray stone columns soared up to a vaulted ceiling. Endless rows of wooden pews faced the altar, and stained glass windows glinted in the dim light of prayer candles. Their footsteps echoed on the stone tiles.
There!
Dan yelled. A door stood open on their left, a steep flight of stairs leading up. Amy latched the door behind them, but she knew it wouldn't hold the Holtz for long. They scrambled up the stairs. Dan started wheezing. Amy put her arm around him and half-carried him. Up, up, up. She hadn't realized the bell tower could be so high. Finally, she found a trap door and threw it open. Rain poured down on her face. They climbed into the belfry, which was open to the storm on all sides. A bronze bell the size of a file cabinet sat in one corner. It looked like it hadn't been rung in centuries.
Help me,
Amy cried. She could hardly move the bell, but together they managed to drag it on top of the trap door.
That should hold,
Dan wheezed.
Little while.
Amy leaned out the side of the tower, into the rain and darkness. The graveyard looked impossibly far below. The cars on the street looked like the matchbox toys Dan used to play with. Amy groped along the stone wall outside the window. Her fingers closed around a cold metal bar. A tiny set of rungs was embedded in the side of the tower, leading up to the steeple, about 10 feet above her. If she fell...
Stay here,
she ordered Dan.
No, sis, you can't. I have to. Here, take this.
She gave him the paper that had been wrapped around the vial.
Keep that dry and hidden.
Dan stuffed it into his pants.
Sis!
He looked terrified. Amy realized more than ever how alone they were in the world. All they had was each other. She squeezed his shoulder.
I'll make it back, Dan. Don't worry. Boom!
The bell shuddered as someone underneath, someone very strong, slammed into the trap door.
Boom!
Amy slipped the glass vial into her pocket and swung one leg out the window into open darkness. She could barely hang on. Rain stung her eyes. She didn't dare look down. She concentrated on the next rung of the ladder, and slowly she pulled herself up onto the slanted tile roof. Finally, she was at the peak. An old iron lightning rod pointed into the sky. At its base was a metal ring like a tiny basketball hoop, and below that a grounding wire, just like Franklin had recommended in his early experiments. Amy lashed the wire around her wrist, then took out the vial. It was so slippery she almost lost it. Carefully, she slipped it into the iron ring. A perfect fit. She inched back down the roof.
Please,
she thought, holding on tight to the rungs. She didn't have to wait long. The hair stood up on the back of her neck. She smelled something like burning aluminum foil, and then, crack! The sky exploded. Sparks rained down all around her, hissing on the wet tiles. Dazed, she lost her balance and skittered down the roof. She grabbed frantically and caught a rung so hard, pain shot up her wrist. But she held on and began to climb back to the top. The glass vial was glowing. The green liquid inside was no longer murky and slimy. It seemed to be made of pure green light trapped in glass. Carefully, Amy touched it. There was no shock. It wasn't even warm. She slipped the vial out of its brace and put it back in her pocket. As thou charge this, so I charge thee. The hardest part was still to come. She had to get away safely and figure out what she'd just created.
Dan, I did it.
She climbed back into the bell tower, but her smile melted. Dan was lying on the floor, bound and gagged. Standing over him in black combat fatigues was Ian Cabra.
Hello, cousin.
Ian held out a plastic syringe.
I'll trade you.
Mmm!
Dan struggled and tried to say something.
Mmm! Mmm!
Let him go,
Amy stammered. She was sure her face was bright red. She hated that she was stuttering again. Why did Ian Cabra turn her tongue to lead? The bronze bell shuddered. The Holts were still pounding away below, trying to get through the trap door.
You only have a few seconds before they come up,
Ian warned.
Besides, your brother needs the antidote.
Amy's stomach clenched.
What have you done to him?
Nothing that can't be reversed if you act in the next minute or so.
Ian dangled the antidote.
Give me Franklin's vial. It's a fair trade.
Mmm!
Dan shook his head violently, but Amy couldn't risk losing him. Nothing was worth that. Not a clue, not a treasure, nothing. She held out the glowing green vial. Ian took it, and she snatched the antidote out of his hand. She knelt next to Dan and started tugging at the gag in his mouth. Ian chuckled.
Nice doing business with you, cousin.
You'll never make it out of the tower. You're trapped up here, the same as...
Then something occurred to her. How had Ian gotten up here in the first place? She noticed straps running across his chest like a climbing harness. At his feet lay a bundle of metal poles and black silk.
Another thing Franklin loved.
Ian picked up his bundle and began fastening the black silk to the metal frame.
Kites. He pulled himself across the Charles River with one, did you know?
You couldn't have...
Oh, yes, I did.
He pointed to the glowing dome of the larger church at the top of the hill.
I sailed right down from Sacré-Cœur, and now I'm going to sail right out again.
You're a thief,
Amy said. Ian hooked his harness to the huge black kite.
Not a thief, Amy. A Lucian, the same as Benjamin Franklin. Whatever is in this vial, it belongs to the Lucians. I think old Ben would appreciate the irony of this.
And just like that, Ian jumped out of the belfry. The wind took him. The kite must have been specially designed to support a human's weight because Ian sailed smoothly down over the graveyard and fence and landed at a controlled run on the sidewalk. Somewhere out in the storm, police sirens screamed. The bell shuddered as the Holt family pounded against the trap door.
Mm! Dan!
Amy had completely forgotten him. She ripped off his gag.
Ow!
He complained.
Just hold still. I've got the antidote.
Ian was bluffing,
Dan groaned.
I was trying to tell you. He didn't give me anything. I'm not poisoned.
Are you sure?
Positive. That stuff he gave you is useless. Or maybe it's poison.
Disgusted with herself for being so stupid, Amy threw down the syringe. She untied Dan and helped him stand. The bronze bell shuddered once more and lurched aside. The trap door burst open. Eisenhower Holt climbed into the belfry.
You're too late,
Dan told him.
Ian took it.
He pointed toward the street. A cab had just pulled up with Natalie Cabra in back. Ian climbed in and they took off through the streets of Montmartre. Mr. Holt growled.
I'll make you both pay for this. I'll...
Sirens wailed louder. The first police car appeared around the corner, blue lights flashing.
Dad!
Reagan's voice called up from the stairs.
What's going on?
A second police car appeared, racing toward the church.
We're leaving, Eisenhower decided.
He shouted down to his family.
Everybody, about face!
He took one last look at Amy and Dan.
Next time!
He let the threat hang in the air and left Amy and Dan alone in the tower. Amy looked out into the rain. She spotted Uncle Alistair hobbling away down a side street, a fudgesicle stuck to the back of his cherry red suit. Irina Spassky staggered out the front of the church, saw the police, and broke into a run.
Arrêtez!
A policeman cried, and two of them started after her. Nellie was standing on the sidewalk with a few more officers. She was yelling frantically in French, pointing to the church. Despite all the chaos, Amy felt strangely calm. Dan was alive. They'd survived the night. She'd done exactly what she needed to do. A smile crept over her face.
Why are you so happy?
Dan complained.
We lost the second big clue. We failed.
No, Amy said. We haven't.
Dan stared at her.
Did that lightning fry your brain?
Dan, the vial wasn't the clue, she said. That was just, well, I'm not sure what it was. A gift from Benjamin Franklin. Something to help in the search. But the real clue is that piece of paper you stuffed in your pants.
Chapter 19. Dan was thrilled that the second clue had been safely smuggled out of the church in his pants.
So, really, I saved the day, he decided. Wait a minute, Amy said. I climbed onto the roof in the middle of a thunderstorm. Yeah, but the clue was in my pants.
Amy rolled her eyes. You're right, Dan. You are the real hero. Nellie cracked a smile.
You both did pretty good, if you ask me.
They were sitting together at a cafe on the Champs-Élysées, watching the pedestrians and enjoying more pain au chocolat. It was the morning after the storm. The sky was blue. They'd already packed their bags and checked out of the Maison des Gardons. All things considered, Dan felt lucky. He'd still had some doubts about what they'd gone through. In particular, he didn't like that Ian and Natalie had gotten away. He'd hated being tied up, and he wanted to get back at Ian. But it could have been worse. At least they hadn't gotten lost forever in the catacombs or slammed in the face with a box of ice cream.
I still want to know what was in that vial, though, he said.
Amy twirled her hair thoughtfully.
Whatever it is, it's supposed to give one team an advantage, freeing the truth. That has to mean the final treasure of the contest. Since Ian and Natalie have the vial, well, I've got a bad feeling we'll find out what it does pretty quick.
If these Lucian dudes created it,
Nellie said, chewing on her croissant,
maybe it's like some special kind of poison. They seem to love poisons. Maybe,
Dan said, though the answer felt wrong. He still didn't like the idea that Ben Franklin was related to Ian and Natalie. He'd started to admire Franklin, what with the fart essays and the lightning and all. Now he wasn't sure if old Ben was a good guy or a bad guy.
But what would poison have to do with a piece of sheet music?
Amy took the parchment out of her backpack and spread it on the table. Dan had already studied it a dozen times. He knew it was an exact copy of the song they'd seen engraved on the stone pedestal in the secret room, but he didn't know why it was important. When he'd woken up that morning, Amy had already been researching on his laptop. Usually she didn't like the internet. For some weird reason, she said books were better, so Dan knew she must have been really desperate for information.
I found it online, Amy said.
How?
Dan said.
I did a search for Benjamin Franklin plus music. It came up right away. That's an adagio for harmonica.
Ben Franklin's instrument,
Dan remembered.
The water on the glass rims thing.
Yeah, but I have a feeling this is more than a musical score.
Amy sat forward. Her eyes were bright like she knew a secret.
We found the song and downloaded it. Listen.
Nellie handed over her iPod.
Not my kind of music, but whatever.
Dan listened. He felt like he was being filled with helium. The music was so familiar and beautiful, it made him want to float across Paris, but it also confused him. Usually he had no trouble remembering things, but he could not recall where he'd heard this music before.
I know this song.
Dad used to play it, Amy said, in his study when he was working. He played it all the time.
Dan wanted to remember what Amy was talking about.
He wanted to listen to the song over and over until he could see their dad in his study. But Nelly took back the iPod.
Sorry, kiddo. You still got, like, mud in your ears.
The notes are a code, Amy said. The whole piece of music is some kind of message.
And our parents knew about it,
Dan said in amazement.
But what does it mean?
I don't know,
Amy admitted.
But Dan, you remember how Mr. McIntyre said the 39 clues are a piece of a puzzle?
Yeah.
I started thinking about that last night, after you decoded that message on the vial. I started wondering, why wasn't the first clue like that?
She brought out the cream paper they'd paid $2 million for. Dan's scrawled notes filled the backside. On the front side was their first clue. Resolution. The fine print to guess. Seek out Richard S. Nellie frowned.
That led you to Franklin, right? Wasn't that the answer?
Only partly, Amy said. It's also the first piece of the puzzle. It's a clue to an actual thing. That clicked for me last night when you mentioned anagrams, Dan.
He shook his head.
I don't get it.
She took out a pen and wrote resolution.
You asked me why this word was part of the clue. I didn't understand until now. We're supposed to guess the fine print.
She passed the paper and pen to Dan.
Solve the anagram.
Dan stared at the letters. Suddenly, he felt like he'd been zapped by a Franklin battery. The letters rearranged themselves in his mind. He picked up the pen and wrote, iron solute.
I don't believe it, Nellie said. This whole thing was about iron solute?
It's the first piece of the puzzle, Amy said. It's an ingredient, or a component, or something like that.
For what?
Dan asked. Amy pursed her lips.
Iron solute could be used for chemistry, or metalworking, or even printing. There's no way to tell yet, and we don't know how much we're supposed to use. Every time Franklin mentioned iron solute, he just wrote one quantity.
We've got to find out.
We will, Amy promised. And the sheet music.
She spread her hands over the adagio score.
It's an ingredient too?
Nellie guessed.
I think so, Amy said. That's how you can tell the big clues. They give you an actual ingredient. We just don't know how to read this one yet.
But how do we find out?
Dan protested.
The same way we did with Franklin. We find out about the person who wrote it. The composer was...
Amy stopped abruptly. Coming down the street was a familiar figure, a thin, balding man in a gray suit carrying a cloth suitcase.
Mr. McIntyre!
Dan cried.
Ah, there you are, children.
The old lawyer smiled.
May I?
Amy quickly folded the first and second clues and put them away. Mr. McIntyre sat with them and ordered a coffee. He insisted on paying for their breakfast, which was okay by Dan, but Mr. McIntyre seemed nervous. His eyes were bloodshot. He kept glancing across the Champs-Élysées as if he was afraid he was being watched.
I heard about last night, he said. I'm so sorry.
It's no big deal,
Dan said.
Indeed. I'm sure you'll be able to backtrack. But is it true? Did the Cabras really steal the second clue from under your noses?
Dan got annoyed all over again. He wanted to brag about the sheet music they'd found and the iron solute thing, but Amy cut in.
It's true, she said. We have no idea where to go next.
Alas, Mr. McIntyre sighed. I fear you can't go home. Social services are still on alert. Your aunt has hired a private detective to find you, and you cannot stay here. Paris is such an expensive city.
His eyes fixed on Amy's necklace.
My dear, I do have friends in the city. I know this would be a desperate measure, but I could possibly arrange a sale for your grandmother's...
No, thank you, Amy said. We'll get by just fine.
As you wish.
Mr. McIntyre's tone made it clear he didn't believe her.
Well, if there's anything I can do, if you need advice...
Thanks, Mr. McIntyre,
Dan said.
But we'll figure it out.
The old lawyer studied them both.
Very good. Very good. I fear there's one more thing I must ask of you.
He reached down for his cloth bag, and Dan noticed the claw marks on his hands.
Whoa, what happened to you?
The old man winced.
Yes, well,
he plopped the bag on the table. Something inside said,
Merp.
Saladin,
Amy and Dan cried together. Dan grabbed the bag and unzipped it. The big silver cat slinked out, looking indignant.
I'm afraid we didn't get along.
Mr. McIntyre rubbed his scarred hands.
He was not happy when you left him with me. He and I... Well, he made his feelings quite clear that he wanted to be returned to you. It was quite a task getting him through customs, I don't mind telling you, but I really felt I had no choice. I hope you'll forgive me.
Dan couldn't help grinning. He hadn't realized just how much he'd missed the old cat. Somehow, having him here made up for losing the vial. It even made him feel a little better about losing his parents' photograph. With Saladin around, he felt like his family was complete. For the first time in days, he thought maybe, just maybe, Grace was still looking out for them.
He's got to come with us. He can be our attack cat.
Saladin stared at him, as if to say, Show me some red snapper, kid, and I'll think about it. Dan expected Amy to argue, but she was smiling as much as he was.
You're right, Dan. Mr. McIntyre, thank you.
Yes, of course. Now, if you'll excuse me, children, I wish you good hunting.
He left a 50-euro bill on the table and hurried out of the cafe, still looking around like he expected an ambush. The waiter brought milk in a saucer and some fresh fish for Saladin. Nobody at the cafe seemed to think there was anything strange about sharing breakfast with an Egyptian Mao.
You didn't tell Mr. McIntyre about the music, Nellie said. I thought he was your friend.
Mr. McIntyre told us to trust no one, Amy said. Yeah, Dan said, and that includes him.
Nellie crossed her arms.
Does that include me too, kiddo? What about our agreement?
Dan was stunned. He'd completely forgotten that Nellie had only promised to come with them on one trip. His heart sank. He'd started taking Nellie for granted. He wasn't sure what they would do without her.
I trust you, Nellie, he said. I don't want you to leave.
Nellie sipped her coffee.
But you're not going back to Boston, which means if I go back, I'll get in huge trouble.
Dan hadn't thought of that, either. Amy stared guiltily at her breakfast. Nellie inserted her earbuds. She watched a couple of college-age guys walking down the road.
This hasn't been a bad job, I guess. I mean, if I have to work with two annoying kids. Maybe we could make a different deal.
Dan shifted uncomfortably.
A different deal? Someday when you find your treasure,
Nellie said.
You can reimburse me. For now, I'll work for free. Because if you kiddos think I'll let you fly around the world and have fun without me, you're crazy.
Amy threw her arms around Nellie's neck. Dan grinned.
Nellie, you're the best.
I know that, she said. Come on, Amy, you're messing up my street cred.
Sorry,
Amy said, still grinning. She sat down again and brought out the music score.
Now, as I was saying... Oh, right, the composer,
Dan remembered. Amy pointed at the bottom of the paper.
Look.
In the right-hand corner below the last stanza, Dan made out three scrawled letters in faded black ink. W-A-M.
Wham,
Dan said.
Wasn't that a band? No, dummy, those are initials. I told you some famous people made music for Benjamin Franklin's harmonica. This guy was one of them. Toward the end of Franklin's life, he must have met this composer. I think they were both Cahills. They must have shared secrets. Anyway, I looked it up.
This was the composer's last piece of chamber music. Its official name is KV-617.
Catchy title, Nellie muttered.
The thing is, Amy said, there are lots of copies of this adagio, and there's still the version carved in stone on that pedestal. The other teams will figure out the clue eventually. We have to hurry and get to Vienna.
Whoa, hold on, Dan said. Vienna, Austria? Why there?
Amy's eyes twinkled with excitement.
Because that's where Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart lived, and that's where we'll find the next clue.
Chapter 20. William McIntyre made his appointment just in time. He stepped out onto the observation deck of the Eiffel Tower. The day after a heavy rain, the air was clean and fresh. Paris glistened below as if all its dark secrets had been washed away.
They didn't trust you, the man in black said.
No, William admitted. His colleague smiled.
They learn quickly.
William McIntyre kept his annoyance in check.
Things could have gone worse.
They could have gone much better. We will have to watch them more closely, don't you think?
Already taken care of.
William McIntyre took out his cell phone. He showed his colleague the screen, the last number he had dialed in Vienna, Austria. The man in black made a low whistle.
Are you sure that's wise?
No,
William admitted,
but necessary. Next time, there can be no mistakes.
No mistakes, the man in black agreed.
And together, they watched the city of Paris spread out below them. 10 million people completely unaware that the fate of the world hung in the balance.
G328 Alpha Tango Charlie. This is Inverness Tower.
You're cleared for flight level 10.
N288 Zulu Bravo. This is Inverness Tower. You are cleared for. Hey, Dream, there's an unidentified plane on the panel.
There's no information?
Just a tail number. 5R618GC. But no destination or pilot name.
It's probably just an oversight. But get the pilot on the radio.
618 Golf Charlie. 618 Golf Charlie. This is Inverness Control. Please respond on 122.6.
Try again.
618 Golf Charlie. 618 Golf Charlie. Respond immediately on 122.6.
Inverness Control. This is 618 Golf Charlie.
618 Golf Charlie. Please squawk your transponder. You need to reset it so all your information appears. We can't identify you.
It's for the best.
Who is this? Simon, check who the plane is registered to.
I got it. N618GC is registered to a Grace M. Cahill. The plane is called the Flying Lemur.
Is this Grace Cahill?
Yes, but you really can't tell anyone you spoke to me. If the E-Cats find out, we'll all be in trouble.
What's an E-Cat?
All you need to know is that they have a talent for making people disappear. Have you ever heard of the Bermuda Triangle?
Miss Cahill, I'm beginning to lose my patience. Simon, call security. Tell them we have code...
Wait! If this gets out, it's going to end badly for you. I know how they operate. I urge you not to call security.
We can't let an unidentified plane wander in and out of our airspace. Tell me your destination, and we can try to work this out.
Are you recording this conversation?
It's standard procedure.
Then I really can't say. You have no idea what kind of people will be after you.
Does this have anything to do with the Mafia?
Hardly. My family is much more dangerous.
How much damage can one old lady's family really do?
My family's been behind every major assassination in the past 400 years.
Are you taking the mickey? Jim, maybe we should call that therapist they bring in during hostage situations.
I'm only 20 miles away from my destination. By the time you contact anyone, I'll be long gone.
You're not staying in Scotland?
I'm dropping a package off for a friend, and then I'm on my way.
You flew your own plane to Scotland to hand-deliver a package? What is it?
Something I can't declare on the customs form at the post office.
Fine. 618 Golf Charlie. Please commence a holding pattern while flight control decides how to proceed.
I can't do that. My errand is rather time-sensitive. I have to leave my package and get out before anyone realizes that I was here. You have no idea what's at stake.
You Cahill seem to keep a lot of secrets.
Hello?
Come in, 618 Golf Charlie. 618 Golf Charlie, please respond.
I was too late. They knew what I was doing.
What? Who?
Those ECAT people?
Or the Lucians.
What's a Lucian?
They did something to my plane. Oh, no!
The flying lemur has dropped below 10,000 feet. Way below.
618 Golf Charlie. 618 Golf Charlie. You are cleared for emergency landing. Proceed immediately to runway 4B.
It's too late. I can't believe it's going to end like this. They don't have a chance. They're going to destroy each other.
Who's going to destroy each other?
You have to cover up my crash. No one can investigate it.
No one's crashing. Just tell us what's going on.
There goes the landing gear. Drat those ECATs.
Simon, call James. Tell him we've got a code.
Don't tell anyone. Oh, that might just work. Woohoo!
618 Golf Charlie, are you there? 618 Golf Charlie. 618 Golf Charlie. Respond on 122.6.
That's not good.
Her transponder went off.
Where could she have gone?
I'm not sure. 618 Golf Charlie. Come in. 618 Golf Charlie. Do you copy? 618 Golf Charlie.
This is David Pitu. We hope that you have enjoyed this production of The 39 Clues, Book 1, The Maze of Bones, by Rick Riordan. This program was produced and directed by David Rapkin. Executive producer, Cheryl Smith. Text copyright 2008 by Rick Riordan. Production copyright 2008, Scholastic Inc. All rights reserved.